From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We're going to get you updated on all the news that made headlines this last week, in particular, what's been happening at the legislature. So today, our panel includes Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Christina Lord, the editor-in-chief of the Idaho Capital Sun, and Ruth Brown, producer with Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television. Hi, everybody.
Hey, Gemma. Hey, happy Gemma. Friday.
Happy Friday. Okay, Clark, let's just dive right into the legislature. So they're in recess until April 10th. So can we just start right there? Because why haven't they just ended the session?
Yeah, it's a good question, Gemma. But as you said, they are at recess. They went at recess Wednesday night. So the first time since early January, the halls of the state capitol building are quiet for once. But they went at recess because that allows the Idaho legislature to come back next week on April 10th and potentially override any vetoes that Governor Little would issue. I haven't seen any vetoes yet, but by going at recess, they preserve their ability to go back in and kind of take final action. There was a flurry of legislative activity on Tuesday and Wednesday where dozens of bills were sent to the governor's desk. I believe once those bills reach the governor's desk, he has 5 days to take action, Gemma. And on each of the bills, the governor can sign them into law, or the governor can allow them to become law without his signature, or the governor can veto them, which blocks them from becoming law. So it's kind of this political dance. It's this new adjournment procedure that the legislature has been doing probably for about 6 years now, where rather than immediately adjourning and shutting down for the year when they feel they've wrapped up their business, they take this 5-day recess or so that allows the governor to take action. But that means that they're still in session so that if any of these late bills that barely passed at the end of the session, if the governor does veto them, then the legislature has options to come back and respond versus just completely shutting it down and adjourning for the year. So it's about preserving their power. It's a little bit of political gamesmanship mixed in there as well, based on the fact that we don't quite know what's going to happen with all these bills. So that's kind of why they did it, Gemma, but a little bit of political gamesmanship for sure.
And so, Clark, I'm assuming, though, before they went into recess, they have now passed all of the budgets, including the Idaho Transportation budget.
Yeah, that's true. They one of the last major things they did was the Idaho transportation budget, and this was really something that legislators have fought over at least since March 1. And Gemma, it really held up adjournment of the session. Legislators actually missed their target deadline to adjourn two separate times. They had originally been talking about wrapping up the session back on March 27th, obviously that did not happen. The House got bogged down in budget fights over the transportation budget, over the overall budget procedures that the legislature's budget committee uses. That committee is called the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee, or JFAC. It sets every aspect of the state budget. And then there was a leadership fight in the middle of the session where the Idaho House of Representatives, where the Republicans in the House throughout their old majority leader, Representative Megan Blanksma, and installed new majority leader, Representative Jason Monks. That was likely unprecedented in terms of the majority party expelling a member of leadership during an ongoing session. So the session's really been marked by a lot of disagreements, by a lot of fighting, and by disputes over some of these large transactions that the state is dealing with, in particular, the University of Phoenix, University of Idaho deal, which appears to be dead and appears to have fallen apart, as well as the fight over whether or not to block the sale of the Idaho Transportation Department's former Boise headquarters that is located on State Street. That was one of the real sticking points on the transportation budget. It actually took three different tries to pass a transportation budget. And at the end of the day, it passed Wednesday night by a single vote in the Idaho Senate after two Republicans had switched their votes. And so fighting over big budgets, fighting over these large transactions, fighting over what role the legislature has in oversight of these large transactions. These were all things that held up the end of the session. But yes, the budgets have passed. The transportation budget was the last, or one of the very last, major budgets to pass. And so what we're doing right now is we're going to see if the governor vetoes any of those late session bills, or if the governor vetoes the transportation budget. I don't have any indication one way or the other on what the governor will do. But there is, like I said, this roughly 5-day time period where once the bills reach the governor's desk, he can either sign them into law, allow them to become law without his signature, or veto them and block them from becoming law. And if there is a veto, then that's when we would likely see the legislature come back to town on April 10th and perhaps try to override a veto, which would take a two-thirds majority vote. So the session is still going, technically. They're not obligated to wrap it up on April 10th. April 10th may be the last day, particularly if there are no vetoes and no surprises between now and then. We may well come back and just wrap it up in short order on the 10th, but they're not obligated to. There's no requirement to end it. And so if there's a veto or if there's a fight that comes up, they could just keep going. But you're right that the transportation budget and that big $51 million sale, which the legislature is blocking, were some of the very last fights that went down in the state Capitol building this week, Gemma.
Okay. And so, Ruth, I want to bring you into the conversation as well, because libraries were once again a really hot topic during the legislative session this year. So, can you fill us in on the latest bill to remove, and I'm quote, you know, air quotes, obscene content from library shelves? Because this has cleared the legislature, correct?
It has, yeah. It passed the Idaho Senate. This was a long-awaited library bill. I will say this has been an ongoing topic for 3 years. I think there's been five different versions of the bill. Last year, there was one that did pass but was vetoed by the governor. The latest iteration of the bill, to be clear, does not ban any books, but under the bill, a parent would be able to provide written notice to a public library asking that they relocate certain material, a material that they found within 60 days, and move it to a section of the library that's for adults only. If the library fails to relocate it, and that would likely be because maybe the board doesn't deem it to be obscene content, they find literary value in it, and so they don't move it. A lawsuit could be filed for $250 against that public library, against the institution, as well as for actual damages. Something that I think is worth note is in this bill, it does not put a cap on how much a person could claim in damages, nor does it address who will pay for legal fees. So while $250 doesn't sound like a lot, I know some senators expressed great concern around just the legal fees alone of, say, Rigby Library or Riggins Library having to defend themselves in court over this sort of content. But there are a lot of senators and members of the House that are concerned about content that they believe is obscene. They believe it meets the definition of obscene. A lot of the bills that were offered as examples do refer to gender and race. Some of them were graphic novels about sexual education that were, and those are books that I think would be targeted more towards teenagers' sexual education. They wouldn't, you know, be in the 5-year-old area of the library with the board books. But nonetheless, the legislature was very concerned about them. It passed the Senate 24 to 11, and it is on the governor's desk. He has not signed it yet, as of 12:15 on Friday. So, but I think people are hitting refresh, waiting to see if he does indeed sign it.
Well, and what's interesting about this, Ruth, and please, you follow this much more than I do, but if I remember correctly, there was a library bill in front of the governor last year, right? But he vetoed that.
He did, yes. And that library bill, I believe, had a much higher Clark might have to help me
Like
out there.
fee, right? Like a like it,
Yeah.
I mean, whatever you could
Yeah.
collect, right? Money, yeah.
You would be able to collect, I believe it was 2,000, and now we're down to 250. And so they have significantly dropped it. They've additionally added this waiting period where a library would have 60 days to potentially relocate the book. You know, rather than putting it in the teen section, maybe they would put it in adult-only section. One of the concerns of that is school libraries don't have an adult-only section.
Right.
And I think most public libraries, even while they might have an adult section, you know, kids or teenagers aren't prevented from wandering into that. I spent a lot of time in public libraries as a kid, and nobody ever stopped me from going into the adult section if I wanted an
Yeah.
adult novel.
Well, my
So, it
15-year-old
is
looks like he's,
problematic.
yeah. Well, yeah, my 15-year-old looks like he's 18. So, you know, there's that issue too. Well, I appreciate the update on that. And as you said, I think we are all waiting to see what the governor does with that bill. Christina, this has been a topic that has been discussed quite a bit. I mean, it's made national headlines, and that is the fact that Idaho is losing doctors. In particular, we are losing OBGYNs. And a lot of these OBGYNs have cited really what they call their inability to truly care for their patients due to our strict abortion bans. So, can you fill us in on what happened at the State House on Wednesday in regards to this? And frankly, where we are at the end of the session in terms of any type of exceptions for the health of the mother?
You bet. So, yes, like you mentioned, on Wednesday, representatives from several medical organizations in Idaho gave a presentation at the State House on how the state's abortion laws are affecting how hospitals and clinics around the state are really struggling to recruit and retain OBGYNs in Idaho. These organizations included people from the Idaho Medical Association, the Idaho Coalition for Safe Healthcare, the Idaho chapter of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and even some of these doctors themselves. So during the presentation, these Idaho medical leaders said that the state's physician shortage, which honestly has been in place for years, if not decades, is being severely exacerbated by doctors' confusion about how to practice medicine under Idaho's abortion ban, which only allows abortion if it's needed to save the mother's life and not to protect the mother's health. So Idaho has lost 22% of practicing obstetricians since this abortion ban took effect, according to a report from the Idaho Physician Wellbeing Action Collaborative. And we know that three hospital labor and delivery departments have recently closed within the last year or so, including in Sandpoint at Bonner General Health, Valor Health in Emmett, and most recently in Caldwell at West Valley Medical Center. One of the Canyon County doctors that spoke, Dr. Megan Casper, talked exactly about what you're talking about. She said that there are these constant questions in her head concerning the health versus the life of the mother that were not there before the abortion ban and before these potential criminal charges that could be filed against her. She says when she treats a complicated pregnancy where she knows the fetus will not survive, she asks herself questions like, what is going to be my threshold for her health status, meaning the health of the mother? If the mother starts bleeding, how much bleeding am I going to tolerate? And she says, like, at what point would the bleeding be enough that I feel competent saying, okay, this is life-threatening? But I think it's really important to point out this kind of dissonance between the medical professionals and some of the legislators. We talked to House State Affairs Committee Chairman Brent Crane, who said the legislature is actually waiting to see what the U.S. Supreme Court will decide in a case relating to Idaho's abortion ban. And that's why we haven't seen health of the mother legislation introduced this year like we expected. At the beginning of the session, the governor, legislative leaders all talked about how legislators have been working on this so-called health of the mother legislation, and we did not see it introduced this year. He also said that he disagrees with these medical professionals and their concerns about being prosecuted under Idaho's law. And I want to read his quote because I think it's you, it just shows the disconnect between the providers and the legislature. He says, I think there's still a push to try to undo Idaho's abortion statutes, and they're using doctors, OB docs, as a pawn in this political game, and I'm tired of it, he said. He went on to say, be honest with your doctors. Let them know the provisions that have been in place by the Idaho legislature. There are provisions that are clearly spelled out. But again, the doctors are saying this isn't clear. We have to make these decisions in real time. We have to ask our legal teams, potentially stalling care while women are in these complicated pregnancy situations that they might need an abortion in to protect their health and to be able to have children again after that. So, I think the Democrats in the legislature were especially appalled and disappointed that this Health of the Mother legislation wasn't introduced this year. But it does not seem like there's the will to be able to come back on Wednesday and do this. And so I think these doctors will be in this situation for another, at least another year while some of this plays out.
It's interesting with that
Yeah.
quote, Christina, because it is the thing is, it is the law. I mean, and whether legislators want to say, well, we wouldn't prosecute you, well, you don't get to make that choice. That's up to prosecuting attorneys in every county. And any prosecuting attorney, if they wanted to, could go
Right.
after
And
a doctor
Crane's point
who
was that it
performed
hasn't
something.
happened yet, but I think these doctors are holding their breaths while they're trying to decide what's best for these patients. We know that patients are being taken out of state for some of these procedures that
Right.
used to be able to happen here in Idaho. And so I think there's just a lot of conflict between what the legislators think they've done in statute and what the doctors are saying that they can do to treat these patients.
Gemma, I
Well, and
would
as
just
Gil, go ahead.
jump in. Last week, Idaho Reports had several of these physicians on the show to talk about this very subject. And something that I think is getting missed is aside from women of childbearing age and women in these complicated pregnancies, with this exodus of OBGYNs leaving the state, there is also a shortage of healthcare for women who maybe they're not of childbearing age, but they do need gynecological care. And so it will become, I think, harder and harder for women, particularly women in rural areas, to receive that needed gynecological care because there are some conditions that simply, your nurse practitioner, family medicine physician is not capable or doesn't have the specialty to provide. And so I think we need to remember that it affects things other than just women of childbearing age. While that is the immediate concern, the shortage of physicians has a big picture problem on the healthcare industry and the availability to get gynecological care. So,
Well,
for
it,
what
yeah,
it's worth.
yes, it no, I appreciate that, Ruth. It impacts all women, all women and our health care. And we should be, I think, discussing that more. I will leave it there. Clark, the Idaho House passed a pretty controversial, and some would say Texas-style immigration bill that has been held up in the courts down in Texas. Can you explain this and what this immigration bill looks like, but then also where the bill is right now, since, as we just discussed in the last segment, our legislature is in recess until next week?
Yeah, for sure, Gemma. I'll do my best. We're talking about House Bill 753, and you're absolutely right. A week ago today, last Friday, the Idaho House of Representatives voted 53 to 15 to pass this bill, with the Republicans in the supermajority having enough votes to pass it off the floor. This bill was very quickly introduced very late in the session. It was introduced after the deadline to transmit bills between the House and the Senate had already passed. And so it's unusual. And a lot of times legislators will complain just in general if a major policy bill gets introduced in what was at the time expected to be the last week of the session. But it's House Bill 753. It is the reason we call it a Texas-style immigration bill is because as soon as the Idaho version of the bill was introduced and I got the language, I went online and I entered specific passages of Idaho's bill online, and it was a word-for-word match with very lengthy sections of Texas Senate Bill 4. And Representative Jerron Crane, a Republican from Nampa, the sponsor of Idaho's bill, said it's basically Idaho's version of the Texas law. And this bill, It passed the House, but it has not been taken up in the Idaho Senate yet. So this bill has not passed. It has not been sent to the governor. And unless the Senate takes it up, it will die when the session ends. So as of now, this bill has not passed, but it would make significant changes to how immigration enforcement is handled in the state. It would shift it so that rather than the federal government taking the lead, that local law enforcement officials in Idaho would be empowered to check immigration status. And it would also give magistrate judges in Idaho the power to order someone who violates this new bill to be returned to their country of origin. What the bill would do is it would create a new crime, a new state-level crime in the state of Idaho called illegal entry, where it would basically make it a crime for someone who is not a U.S. citizen to enter the state of Idaho from somewhere other than an official port of entry. That would become a state crime at this point. And as I said, local law enforcement officials would be able to check immigration status of people. This was introduced late in the session by the brother of House State Affairs Committee Chairman Brent Crane, another Republican from Nampa. It was introduced one day. I think the very next day it had a public hearing, and the very next day after that, it was on the House floor. And even some Republicans who want to increase what they would call immigration security had a lot of questions about this and were concerned about how quickly this bill advanced. A lot of times, Gemma, it takes 1 to 2 weeks for a bill to be introduced, read into the House of Representatives, come back for a public hearing, and then go to the floor. It's kind of a lengthy deliberative process that a bill has to follow to become a law. And some people would say that's for a very specific reason, and so that the bill can be vetted so the public can understand what's in the bill. But this bill was put on a fast track where from introduction to vote on the House floor was about 48 hours. And even I'm thinking about Republican Representative Douglas Pickett, Republican from Oakley, Idaho, said, "I appreciate a lot of what's going into this bill, but I am concerned about how quickly it has come forward." And he was concerned that it wasn't fully vetted in the committee level. And so even with the short introduction that the bill had, even in that short amount of time, several groups, including the Idaho Dairymen's Association, a group called PODAIR of Idaho, and the ACLU of Idaho, and the American Immigration Lawyers Association, all came out against this bill. They all worried that there would be constitutional problems with the bill. They noted, as you pointed out, Gemma, that a court has blocked the Texas bill that this was modeled after from taking effect. And then as some of the Democrats said, like House Assistant Minority Leader Lauren Nekachea, a Democrat from Boise, said, "This isn't even the state's job. This is the job of the federal government." So it was a very controversial bill. It was put on a fast track that was quickly moved through the House, but so far the Senate has not taken it up. And so, like I said, at this point, it is not passed Idaho, and unless the Senate takes it up when we come back from recess, the bill would die when the session ends, Gemma.
Okay, thanks for that update, Clark. Appreciate it. So, Ruth, the Senate recently passed funding for the Idaho Launch Program. For folks who aren't familiar, can you quickly explain what that is and then talk about the funding part of this?
Sure. Idaho Launch passed last year by one vote in the House. It's been an initiative promoted by Governor Brad Little. And it's aimed at workforce development. It would provide graduating high school seniors with up to $8,000 for tuition and fees for in-demand careers in Idaho. So, like I said, the program narrowly passed last year. And then this year, the funding bill for it, which would be 80, excuse me, $80 million to fund the first year of the Idaho Launch Grants and would provide grants for more than 8,000 students. Kind of got slow rolled, but they did eventually pass it on Tuesday. There was question around whether I suppose the legislature could effectively kill the program by not funding it. Many members of the House and I think some in the Senate felt that they had an obligation to fund it because at this point, more than 13,000 students across Idaho, so more than 13,000 Idaho high school seniors have applied for it, and some have been approved. So they've applied for whatever community college or program they plan to enter and are banking on this grant being received. And there was question around whether or not the legislature was going to fund it. But they did. And so that moved forward. I don't remember the House vote, but in the Senate, it was 21 to 14 on Tuesday. So
Oh,
not an
okay.
overwhelming support, but enough to get through at least for 1 year.
All right. Thanks for that, Ruth. Christina, let's take a break from the legislature for a second, if we can. And can you tell us about this is super interesting. So power that's been generated from dams in the Northwest, just this last year, it fell to the lowest levels, and we're talking what, more than like 20 years?
Right. So this is a story that we actually picked up from our sister outlet, the Oregon Capitol Chronicle. So if you're interested in Oregon-related news, they've got you covered. But they wrote this story about how hydropower generated for electricity from Oregon and Washington dams fell to historically low levels last year. And experts expect that it could drop even further by this year's end. Officials at the U.S. Energy Information Administration recently published data showing that hydropower generation in the Northwest dropped to a 22-year low last year. And this is important because 11 Western states produce up to 60% of the country's hydroelectricity. Washington, California, and Oregon are the three largest contributors, with Oregon and Washington producing more than one-third of all U.S. hydropower. So both of those states generated 20% less hydropower in 2023 than in 2021. And the agency just attributes this to something that we've talked a lot about, which is climate change. There was low precipitation in the fall and winter, and then in May of last year, there was a heat dome that drove regional temperatures up 30 degrees from the average, and that rapidly melted snow or melted snowpack in the region and things like that. So these officials are really looking at more frequent periods of drought, high temperatures, heavy rains that could influence how hydropower production has output in the future. The story also talked about how officials at the Bonneville Power Administration, which is the federal agency in charge of marketing and coordinating all federally owned dams in the Northwest, said they've been taking climate change more into account when they actually budget for annual energy availability. So, it's just one of those things that this could be a fluke, but they're also really looking at some of the long-term effects of climate change when it comes to hydropower and how much we can rely on it from year to year. So I thought that was really interesting, and obviously we have a lot of hydropower in Idaho as well.
No, very interesting. So, Clark, I want to quickly go back to a little bit of what we were talking about in the beginning of the program today, and that's the sale of the former ITD headquarters on State Street. I know you mentioned this was a big sticking point when it came to the transportation budget, but can you talk just a little bit more in detail about why was this so controversial?
Yeah, for sure. I've really been writing. I looked back through the archives on the Capital Sun, and I've written about this transportation budget and the transportation headquarters so often. I told Christina the other day that I've written about it so much that I have the address of the building memorized. And so that's kind of a bad sign, maybe. But yeah, this has really been going back a couple of years. But the Idaho Press newspaper reported that in January 2022, the building flooded. I think an HVAC water line or an HVAC pipe broke. The building flooded in the middle of winter, and it was subsequently contaminated with asbestos. And so the Idaho Transportation Department's board voted to declare the property surplus property and sell it. And this is a very attractive piece of property because of its location and its size. I think we're talking about not just the building, but like 45 acres on State Street that's located right near the Boise River Greenbelt. It's located right near Esther Simplot Pond. It's close to downtown. It's close to the State Capitol building. It's a very desirable piece of real estate. And so the Transportation Board voted to declare it surplus property, put it up for sale, and then a group of three developers, including Hawkins Companies, the Pacific Companies, and FJ Management, submitted a high bid to buy the property. I was at a tour of the property in November, and state officials said they sold the State Street campus for $51 million. And then fast forward to this legislative session on March 1st, the legislature's budget committee, which again is JFAC, decided to block the sale. And they said it's going to be more financially responsible to hold on to that building and to renovate it than to sell it and pay another $56 million, which was the estimated cost to relocate the Idaho Transportation Department, move them from State Street to a different state business campus on Chinden Boulevard. And so the idea was legislators said, we will never be able to afford to buy this property back if we sell it. We think it's the most financially responsible use of the taxpayer dollars that make up the state budget to hold on to the building and to renovate it and to have the transportation department use it again. Some legislators said that, but this divided the legislature. Gemma, it actually delayed adjournment of the legislative session. And there was another camp of legislators who said, hold on, the state has a deal. That it's not right for the state to go in, for the state legislature to try and block this deal. Everything, it appears that these developers followed all the rules and laws. There was a competitive open bidding process. These developers, led by Hawkins Companies, submitted the high bid. And they said they have a deal and they're now weighing their legal options. And some state legislators say a deal is a deal and this is going to hurt the state's standing in the business world and in the real estate world. So it was maybe a little bit of buyer's remorse. It was an idea that maybe we could save more money actually by renovating the building rather than selling it, but it really tied the legislature into knots. I mean, we're talking about budget votes that pass by a single vote, one way or the other. This was the third version of the budget. One died in the Senate, one died on a parliamentary move, and this was the third version that was just passed. One of the last bills passed on Wednesday night before going at recess. And so that sale really tied the legislature in knots. But the budget had so much more to it than just the sale of that building. It also had $200 million to repair bridges across the state. And get this, Gemma, in the State of the State address this year, Governor Brad Little said the state of Idaho has 900 bridges that are either rated as poor or predate the moon landing. And so this was a big, high-profile budget that had hundreds of millions of dollars in it. It wasn't just the sale of the building, but the funding for the bridge repair is included in the budget. So the budget blocks the sale of the headquarters. As of now, the state appears to be hanging on to that building, but the budget does include the $200 million, which is the final, basically, effort of a third year effort to repair and replace these aging bridges all across the state. So it was a high profile, important budget with hundreds of millions of dollars in it. But it was really that sale really divided the legislature, delayed adjournment, and it was quite a mess. And so we're waiting and standing by to see that bill, that budget bill, and a handful of other bills, including the library bill and other budgets, to see whether the governor vetoes everything, anything at all, or whether he signs everything into law. So that's kind of where things stand right now. But it was a big, dramatic fight for weeks and weeks, Gemma.
Ruth, can you talk about an order that Idaho U.S. District Court Judge Windmill just ordered when it comes to the Idaho Department of Corrections and what their need to disclose more information in regards to execution drugs?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked this question. It was a story I wrote last week that didn't get a lot of attention because the legislature is always stealing the spotlight. But yeah, it's monumental news as far as transparency, I believe, regarding executions. So, backing up, in 2021, Gerald Pizzuto Jr., who's a man on death row, filed a lawsuit against the Department of Corrections asking the state not to execute him using pentobarbital due to his multiple medical conditions. He argued that it would cause severe pain and constitute cruel and unusual punishment, which is a constitutional violation. In the process of discovery, which is how attorneys get evidence in trials, In the process of discovery, Mr. Bizzuto's attorneys asked for multiple pieces of information regarding how execution drugs are obtained. The rub is in that in 2022, the Idaho legislature passed a law that would grant anonymity to the manufacturers of chemicals that are procured to the state for the use of lethal injection chemicals. It's getting harder and harder for the state to obtain them. You can't just get a prescription from a doctor. It's very hard to obtain these chemicals. Judge Windmill, in his order, did argue that there are several pieces of information IDOC can and will be required to release regarding the execution drugs that would not violate the legislature's law. That would not jeopardize, I guess, informing the public of where the manufacturer came from. Among them, the judge granted Bizzuto's request that IDOC would be required to release the geographic origin of the chemicals, whether they were obtained in the United States or whether they were obtained in a foreign country, and if they were imported. They would be required to provide Mr. Bizzuto with information on it if the chemicals came from a veterinary source or a hospital, and whether the drugs were also sold by a wholesale distributor or a pharmacy. The judge granted that request. IDOC must also admit or deny if the execution drugs were manufactured by Acorn, which is a now bankrupt pharmaceutical company that has had some, I would say, many has had many legal complications. IDOC will also be required to provide Mr. Pizzuto with an unredacted copy of the certificate of analysis done on the chemicals. And I know to maybe your listeners, this sounds like just run of the mill, but this is a huge step for Idaho because the beautiful thing about the courts is that everything that is submitted to the court becomes public record. And I think there are not just Mr. Pizzuto, but the other individuals who are sitting on death row right now would like to know where IDOC is finding these chemicals to execute someone. I know if I were on death row, I'd probably want to know. But they're for a variety of legal reasons, I think this is a big step. Judge Windmill ordered the issue the IDOC to disclose this information. I believe it was last Thursday, and they have 14 days to do so.
Oh, okay.
And I just checked the filings, and it's not it they haven't responded to the order yet.
Okay.
So we will see, but it is a big step, especially following the failed execution of Thomas Creech back in February.
Oh, right.
That did not have to do with the chemicals necessarily, but the source of the chemicals that they were going to use in Mr. Creech's execution, we still do not know. Those haven't been disclosed. And so I think the more transparency, the better. And I think this is probably a big win for Mr. Pizzuto's attorneys.
Well, I want to thank all of you for your time today. So appreciate all of the reporting you do, all of the expertise you bring to the table. So make sure you check out all of these great journalists, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Christina Lords, the editor in chief of the Idaho Capital Sun, and Ruth Brown, producer with Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.